This is Science Friday. I'm Anoush Zamarodi, host of WNYC's Note to Self podcast, sitting in for Ira Flatto. Later in the hour, a look at the microbiome of babies. But first, each of the epochs in the geological timescale has its own distinctive features, markers that you can see, preserved right into the rocky layers of the Earth. The early Cambrian strata is filled with a wide variety of shelled invertebrates. The early Jurassic has signs of flowering plants and large dinosaurs. And what does the Anthropocene, the human epoch, look like in the bedrock? A study out in the Journal of Science looked at just that, and my next guest is here to tell us about that story and our other selected short subjects in science. Brandon Keim is a freelance writer based out of New York City, and he joins us here in our CUNY studios. Welcome, Brandon.
Hi, Manoush. Great to be here.
So, okay, let's start out. What does the geological layer of the Anthropocene look like?
Well, when those archaeologists a million years from now are digging up their geological cores or looking at the fossil record, what they're going to see is, really that our time is very distinct, that there's all kinds of plastic and aluminum everywhere, pretty much. Mm. Carbon dioxide levels and methane levels went really high. The nitrogen cycle of Earth was altered. The phosphorus cycle was altered. And also, really critically, the plant and animal communities of Earth just got really radically rearranged. Really just in the last 50 years or so.
I mean, that's pretty quick, right?
It's really quick. And there had actually been some debate in the circles of people who debate these things about whether the Anthropocene was something you could think of as starting, a couple hundred years ago or a couple thousand years ago. But what these scientists said is that, it's about 1950.
Wow. Okay. We got to move on to the next story, which comes from the opposite end of the geological spectrum. A study that looks at vernal pools, a vernal pool from 365 million years ago. Okay. Let's just start. What is a vernal pool?
So a vernal pool, the word vernal means spring. And these are bodies of water that are typically wet just for part of the year, usually in springtime, as it were. And This week, researchers in the journal Current Biology described this vernal pool 365 million years ago. This is a long time. It's like 100 million years before the first dinosaur.
Before the dinosaurs.
Yeah, I mean, just very long time. And so what they observed, actually, is that the little fairy shrimp and water fleas and invertebrates in the water that were in that vernal pool looked a great deal like the invertebrates you'd find in a vernal pool now. Not identical, but, this spring, go out and find a vernal pool, get down on your hands and knees, take a look in, and you're going to be getting a little window into what the world was like 365 million years ago.
Amazing. Okay, so some things really do never change. Now let's go to the standoff at the Malheur Wildlife Refuge. It's in its 14th day now, and a few scientists are starting to weigh in. Is it the scientists who have been displaced, essentially?
No, they, as far as I know, they've been keeping quiet, but last week, it was a couple of journalists from Reuters described the occupants of the wildlife refuge in the office of a biologist named Linda Sue Beck, kind of making fun of her work. And one of them was quoted saying something along the lines of, she's part of what's destroying America. And some other scientists and people who care about scientists and science really really got up, I was going to say up in arms about this. I should not say
no.
That. Really got upset about this. And a biologist named Travis Longcourt wrote this wonderful article. It's entitled "I Stand with Linda Sue Beck," where he was saying, this is really an attack on the idea of science and the role of scientists in society. And I think that, however one feels about all the other political issues involved here, it's just wrong for science and scientists to end up, in the crosshairs, figuratively and literally, of what's happening.
That's really a shame in that part. And then we want to talk finally, which is so interesting. Researchers conducted the chimp equivalent of the human trust fall.
So trust is one of those things that, maybe we don't think about it all that much, but it's so foundational to human experience, right? Like, imagine your own life without trust. It would be this terrible thing. And so these researchers, it was led by Jan Engelman of the Max Planck Institute, and they were publishing in the journal Current Biology, wondered, what about chimpanzees? And so at a sanctuary in Kenya, they designed this experiment where a chimp would be able to pull a rope and get a couple pieces of banana. And if you're a chimp, like, this is not any great thing. This is a pretty blah meal. Or you could pull another rope, and then another chimp would get this feast of bananas and apples, too. But, of course, you would only do that if you trusted the other chimp to share that food with you. Otherwise, you just take the banana for yourself. And what the researchers found is that, the chimps trusted their friends to share with them. And I asked Dr. Engelblin, the lead scientist, you know, well, how's this different from, let's say, dogs who roll over and show their belly to another dog when they play, or sperm whales.
Yeah.
You know, the moms will leave their calves with other whales while they go and hunt. And
wait, sperm whales, like babysitting? Shared babysitting?
They have shared babysitting.
That's awesome. Okay.
That's awesome. And it's something you would want to trust the whale who's watching your baby. And the researcher said, yeah, well, you know, that probably looks like trust too. And, you know, for me, I think I fall into a trap sometimes of thinking about animal interactions as, you know, either being kind of instinctive and mindless or else, you know, very calculating, you know, what's in it for me all the time. But this just points to a new way of thinking about it. You know, trust is all around us, and it's as important to other animals as it is to us.
And is it evolutionary important? Does it give them an advantage in any way?
The study didn't address that, but I would say certainly any species, any assemblage of animals where the individuals can trust one another is going to get a lot more done than one where everybody's watching their back.
Yeah, I mean, that makes complete and utter sense. Can I just ask you one follow-up to the Anthropocene question right at the beginning? How will we know if that is indeed when that era started in the 1950s? When will scientists be able to tell us?
Well, I mean, the ultimate proof will be in a million years where we're digging down into the rock and looking at it. You know, but from the evidence we have right now, it, you know, all of those patterns that I mentioned, the carbon dioxide emissions and plant and animal disruption and what have you, you know, you just, from the evidence that we have right now, you just see the rates of change just spiking upwards, you know, right around the middle of the 20th century.
Just makes me think of The Graduate. Plastics. Remember that line?
Exactly.
Plastics. Plastics. All right. Brandon Keim is a freelance writer based out of New York City. Thank you so much for being here. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Okay. Now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Shakespeare wrote that brevity is the soul of wit. On Twitter, it's also built into the platform. The little blue bird operates by very strict rules. Make your point in 140 characters or less, or just don't make it. But that might be about to change. Last week, the Twitter sphere got word that the company was considering a new character limit. Instead of 140, think 10,000. What could be good or bad about a more verbose Twitter? Will Oremus is senior technology writer at Slate, and he is here to talk about it. Welcome, Will.
Thanks.
Okay, so before we start speculating, what do we know at this point about what Twitter is planning?
All we know is that there have been reports that Twitter is working on a project that they call internally Beyond 140. And the report from the tech blog Recode said that they're looking at a new character limit of 10,000, which would obviously radically reshape the platform if that were literally true.
No. Okay, so is there good news here for fans of the 140 character limit? Is that good news?
Well, it sounds awful if you like Twitter.
Horrible.
I mean, what you like about Twitter is that everybody has to keep things snappy. You know, you can't just ramble on and on. Twitter would be a mess if everybody were tweeting 10,000 characters every time.
You would only see like one post at a time instead of that beautiful thing where you scroll, scroll, scroll.
Yeah, it would look like Tumblr or an old school web blog or something. The good thing is, if you like Twitter, that's not really what's going to happen, I don't think. Even if the reports are true, what's likely to happen is that tweets will still be roughly 140 characters. What you'll be able to do in some cases is to post much longer content, have 140 characters sort of advertisement for that content, and then at the bottom of the tweet, you can click to expand, and then something will drop down, and people can read the whole story there on the platform.
Which isn't that different. I mean, you can put links there now. So does this bring us to what could be the bad news here?
Yeah, that's right. So as you alluded to, there are already plenty of ways for people to pack more than 140 characters into a tweet. You can put a photo on there. You can tweet a Vine. And often people will tweet links to stories that are out there on the web. Now, what this will do, I think, in effect, is to change what happens when you click that link. Instead of being a link to an article out there on the web, you will read the article right there on Twitter. Now, if you are a publisher, if you're somebody who puts that content out on the web, you rely on sites like Twitter and Facebook to drive traffic to your website. What this could do is keep that keep those eyeballs right there within the Twitter app or the Facebook app, and that could be bad news for the publishers.
So, but for the tech companies, that's what they want, right? They don't want people finding an article and then leaving to go to Slate, for example, or, I don't know, ScienceFriday.com to read something, and they want to keep them right where they are. So the trouble is then ad revenue for the publishing industry?
Yeah, that could be part of it. So this is part of a broader trend where Silicon Valley tech companies are looking to take a lot of that content that's out on the web and to bring it into their own platform. So Facebook has done this recently in the form of what it calls instant articles. These are articles that are published right on Facebook. And so the New York Times will write a story, but instead of being on nytimes.com, it'll be on Facebook. And there's something good about that, which is that when you're on Facebook or Twitter and you go to click a link, if you're like me, you probably shudder because you don't know, is it going to load really slowly?
Right.
Are there going to be these horrible pop-up ads? You know, is it going to look like a mess on your phone? And so if it opens right there within the app, it'll look much better.
I mean, I have to say, as a user of Twitter, that sounds pretty great. As a journalist, it sounds like the demise of my very essence of being.
Yeah, this is probably only good news for consumers unless it means that ultimately there's less of that good stuff out there on the web to read in the first place.
Okay, so when can we expect to find out whether, beyond 140? That's the secret code word?
Supposedly, yes.
Okay, when do you think we're going to find out whether this is actually going to happen?
Well, the latest report says that it could happen by the end of the first quarter, so that would be in the next couple of months.
Okay. And this is Jack Dorsey who's back at the helm, right? The CEO who was one of the creators and now is back as CEO?
Yeah, the prodigal son of Twitter. Jack Dorsey is back. This is his initiative. And in fact, he responded to it in a really sort of coy way. He responded to these rumors by posting a tweet that was nothing but a screenshot of text. And it was way more than 140 characters. So he was demonstrating the ways in which Twitter already lets you tweet more than 140 characters at a time.
Okay. Well, speaking of brevity, that's all the time we have. Will Arimus is senior technology writer at Slate. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so after the break, a look at the future of construction materials, but out in deep space. This is Science Friday. I'm Anoush Zamarodi, sitting in for Ira Flatow. Last month, right before the holidays, NASA received an end-of-the-year gift from its Secret Santa, a bigger budget. Congress approved the space agency's funding, a $1.3 billion increase from last year, and nearly $800 million more than the White House had requested. So what's covered in the budget, and how does this funding outline the goals of NASA? My next guest is here to take us through the accounting. Eric Berger is the senior space editor for Ars Technica. He's based out of Houston, Texas. Hi, Eric.
Hey, good afternoon, Manoush.
Hey there. So why was there an increase in the budget this year? That seems very counterintuitive.
Well, you may recall that at the end of 2015, Congress, both Republicans and Democrats, kind of came together with a deal. And as part of that, they came up with some more money for the overall budget. And NASA has a lot of friends in both the House and the Senate. And both chambers kind of have their favorite parts of the space agency's budget. So when it came time to allocate money, NASA did pretty well.
So can you just break it down for us? What areas within NASA actually got a boost?
So the biggest winner in terms of the overall budget from what the president proposed was the Space Launch System. This is the large rocket that NASA is building. It says it's part of its journey to Mars. That got a nearly 50% increase in its budget, more than $600 million than the president sought.
And were there any areas that were overlooked that didn't receive as much funding?
No, pretty much every area got what it wanted. There had been a lot of controversy earlier in the year because the House and the Senate budget responses basically to the president had provided less money in two key areas. One was commercial crew. This was the effort to replace the space shuttle and the American reliance on Russia for transportation. So Boeing and SpaceX are building these vehicles. Both houses of Congress had basically provided $300 million less than the administration sought. And the other issue was Earth science funding. There are some skeptics or deniers in Congress who, you know, do not believe in that humans are causing climate change, and they had actually underfunded the Earth science budget by nearly $500 million.
Can we go back to the Russia point that you made? So basically, up until now, we've been using the Russians to get into space. Is that right?
Or for since 2011.
Since 2011. Okay, so this was an attempt to sort of take back power, if you will, to get us into space?
Yeah, It's an effort to do a couple things. First of all, it is an effort to launch humans from America's soil again. And NASA had been saying it was on track to do that by the end of 2017. It said if it did not get full funding for commercial crew this time, that that date was going to slip into 2018 or beyond. So basically, it was putting Republicans in the House and the Senate in the position of if they didn't fund it, they were going to look like they were willing to spend money on the Russian defense program.
Okay, so it all comes back to politics. I mean, the other thing that you mentioned in your article, which I found fascinating, which was that the budget includes a few very specific deadlines, and one is to have a lander on Europa, which is Jupiter's moon, by 2022. I mean, that sounds pretty ambitious, and I understand it's because of a particular Republican.
Yeah, so each the Senate kind of has their favorite things, and they like the big rocket, the space launch system in the House. There's the chairman of the Appropriations Subcommittee. He's a guy from Houston named John Culberson, and he is really interested in the moon Europa. Now, Europa is this fascinating place. It's covered in ice. It's bathed in radiations from Jupiter's surface. It creaks. It kind of goes up and down. It feels this massive gravitational pull from Jupiter. Hmm. But beneath the surface is an ocean. You know, there's more water on Europa than there is on Earth. And there's a heat source because you have this tidal flexing of the core of Europa. And so if you're going to look for life that's living now in the solar system today, that's probably the best place to look.
I mean, that sounds fascinating. But in your article about the mission, you say that NASA's administrator, Charles Bolden, only grudgingly accepted this mission. Why would that be?
Well, there's a couple reasons. First of all, he and Culberson really don't see eye to eye that well.
Okay.
Bolden was appointed by a Democratic president, and they have different priorities. He also didn't want to take on another big ambitious mission. This is probably a $1 to $2 billion mission, and so he wasn't sure that he was going to get funding through 2022 or 2023 launch date.
So, and is he like, okay, fine, we'll go to Europa now?
I think so. I talked to Culberson after the budget deal, and apparently they sort of came to an agreement that, okay, we're going to do the Europa mission. And so now we'll see in next year's budget whether NASA and the president really ask for as much money as it needs, which will be a couple hundred million dollars.
You had also written about investment in the space launch system, a lot of money that NASA's putting into that. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so this is the big rocket, a heavy lift rocket, and NASA initially was told to have it ready by the end of 2016. The launch date has now slipped probably until 2018, and we're probably seeing also slippages in terms of, you know, putting people on it in the Orion spacecraft. And so Congress is stepping up and saying, here's more money, you know, please try to stick to these launch dates. But then you have other people in the space community saying this rocket program is so big and so expensive that the delays are inevitable regardless of how much money you put into it.
God, fascinating stuff. All right. Eric Berger is the senior space editor for Ars Technica. Thank you so much, Eric.
My pleasure.
So in the NASA budget, $55 million was put aside to build a deep space human habitation prototype. This is a ship that a crew could live and work out of, maybe on the way to Mars. The destination isn't set yet, but the deadline for the prototype is 2018. NASA has just 2 years to figure out a model for this shuttle. And the agency has been quiet about any blueprints, but researchers are already thinking big. What might a deep space habitat look like? And how could you build a habitat right on the surface of Mars? My next guests are here to talk about this deep space design and the future of space construction. Gianluca Cusatis is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University, and Bruce Lieberman is a freelance science writer based out of San Diego. So, Bruce, you've talked to engineers who are building these types of shuttles, and they say that there's a great future in inflatables, inflatable spacecrafts. I mean, is that kind of like a bouncy castle that one might have at a kid's birthday party? Because I got to say, that's what I'm picturing.
You know, I was thinking about how to describe these, and these are not party balloons. They're
okay.
You know, when you think of these, you might think of astronauts bouncing around in these giant party balloons, but that's not what it is. It's a rigidized inflatable habitat that has numerous layers of protection and thermal blanket covering. And this is something that could be conceivably attached to a propulsion system that would give astronauts a lot of living space on their way to a destination, whether it's an asteroid or Mars or the moon.
And what are the advantages then to like an inflatable? What's wrong with metal? What's the plus side?
Well, Bigelow Aerospace is the company in North Las Vegas that is working on this technology. And the way they market this technology is that it has a few really great features. It's cheap. It's relatively cheap compared to other modules. It's lightweight. It's compact. And it has some advantages to aluminum pressure vessels as far as radiation protection. When high-energy particles from the sun or cosmic rays hit a metal pressure vessel, it creates what's called secondary radiation, which creates this shower of subatomic particles that can enter astronauts' bodies and create damage. So a fabric or an inflatable habitat would not create as much of this secondary radiation. And so there would be
like
less
of that. Is it kind of like Kevlar or something?
Is
the fabric?
So the actual construction of the habitats is proprietary. So NASA and Bigelow wouldn't say exactly what it's made of, but it is supposed to be a Kevlar-like fabric that would help protect astronauts from orbital debris that's orbiting the Earth, and then also micrometeoroids. But that would not have anything to do with the radiation protection.
Okay, and I want to just know, like, how big an inflatable can you actually make? Because the crew would need to be in these things for quite some time, right? Like, I assume that comfort factors in somehow.
That's right. So right now, Bigelow is anticipating the launch of a test habitat that would be docked to the International Space Station for 2 years. And that launch was supposed to happen around early September, but because of the SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket exploded shortly after launch in June, the launch of this test module was postponed until sometime this year. That's called the Bigelow Expandable Activity Module, or BEAM, B-E-A-M. And this is fairly small, but the operational habitat, which would advance if BEAM is successful, would be 330 cubic meters. And if you consider that, that alone is about one-third of the room that the entire space station now gives astronauts.
So massive, then.
Yes, yes. It would give astronauts a lot of space for in-orbit operations, or if they're heading somewhere, like I said, like the Mars or Moon or something.
So, Gianluca, I want to ask you, you came up with a recipe for actually making concrete in Mars, on Mars. How did you get interested in this idea?
So the idea came from a previous research at NASA, where they were exploring settlement on the moon. And because, you know, you don't think about shipping cement and water and gravel, which are the main component of concrete here on Earth, they explored the use of sulfur to bind and to glue together the lunar soil. And so a few years back, based on this early work, we started to look at what this idea would be if extending to be used on Mars. And so I had a student of mine that went buying some Martian soil, believe it or not, you
uh-huh.
can buy.
Really?
A simulant. You know, it's a simulant. It's not really a Martian soil. But,
okay.
And then sulfur. And the technology is very simple. You melt the sulfur and becomes liquid, and then you mix with the Martian soil, and then it hardens, and it is a solid and possible construction material.
So just tell us a little more. What is the optimum mix then that you found?
So that was a surprise that our discovery. While a regular sulfur concrete, typically you have about 20% of sulfur in the mix, we found with specific mineralogy of the Martian soil, you need a 50-50 proportion between Martian soil and sulfur to get optimal performances. But the surprise was also that with those proportions, the performance of the material was higher or relatively higher than the usual concrete that we use here on Earth.
You mean it was stronger then?
It was stronger, about twice as strong.
Huh.
And which is interesting because if you adjust that also for the gravity, because, you know, Mars is about one-third of what we have here on Earth, we calculated that you have a strength that is comparable to the one that we use here on Earth to build skyscrapers. So that was very interesting, I think.
I mean, it sounds kind of like you came upon the perfect thing. What, are there any drawbacks about using and producing this concrete on Mars?
Well, yes, there are drawbacks. So the one that is also a plus is the fact that, you know, being still sulfur-based, it melts back to liquid if you heat it up. So in a case of fire or high temperature, definitely that is not something that you want to have in your house. And that is the reason why we don't use sulfur concrete here for structural application on Earth. However, for especially the first settlement on Mars, I think the first thing is going to have shelters, right? And people are thinking even about ice as a possibility for shelters on Mars. So I think this fire resistance, which of course you need to have, you know, in a building, might not be the first priority when humans will go to Mars. So,
I'm Anoush Samarodi, and you are listening to Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. So, Bruce, let's go back to you. Are these companies looking into using these habitats on the surface of Mars? Or why not the moon? Why Mars or the moon?
I think that Bigelow does envision habitats on the surface of the moon or Mars. I think that's pretty far away as far as becoming a reality. Right now, the beam needs to be tested, and it really needs to go through a series of tests to prove its viability. So once that happens, then they'll test this B330, which is the 330 cubic meter habitat. But eventually, far in the future, there could be something on the surface of Mars or the moon. But that's, I think, pretty far in the future.
So, Gianluca, would it protect against radiation? Because as we heard earlier, that's a problem for people out there.
Right. Well, concrete in general is a good shielding for radiation. So definitely, you know, we haven't done specific research on that, but I imagine that would be a good material for protecting from radiation. And certainly it's going to be a good material for protecting from debris and meteorites and impacts that you might have on the surface of Mars.
Have you heard anything from NASA about your concrete mix?
No, we haven't. No, all the research really was unfunded. Was all the motivation of one of my students. So this is a testament of excellence of our students, who was interested in this work. And she, you know, her name is Lin Wen, and she did both the research that she was supposed to do and this research on the side. So. But we're waiting, so we hope we can continue this research. There are still a lot of open questions. As a matter of fact, our research answered a few questions, but there are more others to be answered.
And can you just let our listeners know, you had mentioned that there are Mars concrete mix simulant available to regular people. Can you tell us just a little more about that for people who are curious?
Yes. So that is a product that NASA developed a while back. I think they do that for also other planets. So they try to mimic the same chemical composition and particle size distribution of these soils, of these materials. And you know, you go on the internet and you can order, and then they ship it to you. It's expensive, you know. I think a few pounds of that was for $500. So, but you can buy it.
Okay, so I'm not going to do it for my kid's next birthday party. That's not going to be the craft that we make then, I guess. And so, Bruce, when you have heard about this concrete mixture, does that make you think that there's a lot of research and trial and error is going to have to happen before we actually build these things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, to do these construction projects on another planet would be a huge undertaking. We have to get humans to Mars first to see how they do there and how they work in the environment before we can build anything, obviously.
Gentlemen, thank you both so much. Gianluca Cusatis is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Northwestern University. Bruce Lieberman is a freelance science writer based out of San Diego. When we come back, a look at the microbiome of babies and how it comes to be. This is Science Friday. I'm Anoush Zamarodi, host of WNYC's Note to Self podcast, sitting in for Ira Flatow. A baby in the womb is protected from most microorganisms, but when that baby enters the outside world, it's quickly greeted by a welcoming committee of bacteria, and those bacteria are there to stay. They take up residence on the baby's skin and in the gut and help form the infant's microbiome. Now, researchers are trying to sort out what effect factors like an infant's delivery method and early diet have on its community of microorganisms. Joining me now are two authors of a paper published this week in the journal JAMA Pediatrics on that topic. Juliette Madden is a pediatrician and neonatologist at the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, and Anne Holm is an assistant professor of epidemiology and of biomedical data science at the Geisel School of Medicine of Dartmouth College as well. And they both join me from Vermont Public Radio Studios. Welcome.
Thank you.
Hi, great to be here.
So, Anne, why do this? Didn't we already know that the microbiome of babies can be different depending on whether they are delivered via C-section versus a vaginal delivery?
Yeah, that's something that has been studied before. In fact, there's a study out there that showed that these effects can persist months or even years into childhood. So we weren't surprised when we found that in our study. But what we did want to do is compare the effect of delivery mode with that of feeding. And when I say feeding in young babies, we're talking about either breast milk or formula feeding, and find out which one is more important and sort of what their relative effects are. So that's one of the new things that we did in our study.
Okay, so trying to figure out what a normal healthy infant microbiome is. And Juliette, who are these babies?
These are babies who are part of a large birth cohort study in New Hampshire, and we're part of Children's Center for Environmental Research and Disease Prevention at Dartmouth. So we've been able to study a cohort that's growing, and it will ultimately be a cohort of 1,500 mothers and babies in the state of New Hampshire. So we're collecting data about pregnancies, both biologic data and health information about pregnant women, and then subsequently very detailed biologic and health data from their babies up until approximately 5 years of age.
So sort of a longer look at this. And so, Anne, what is the difference in the microbial communities of babies born via vaginal delivery versus C-section?
So we looked at the overall microbiome profiles in these two groups of infants, and we found a number of that they were, first of all, significantly different overall. But we also drilled down and looked at which specific bacteria were driving those differences. And one of the bacterial groups that we found was more abundant in vaginally born babies as opposed to C-section born babies was a bacterium called Bacteroides, which has been shown before to be differentially abundant in vaginally born infants. And it's important for immune training, so it helps T cells to mature. So we think that that's likely got important consequences for diseases that are associated with the immune system, like allergies and risk for common infections. And we found a number of other bacteria. Some of them, you know, we know more about than others, but overall their communities were very different.
I mean, I have to say I'm surprised that the C-section babies had bacteria at all, because aren't they being born in a sterilized operating room, or that's the idea anyway?
So we're just starting to understand that fetuses are probably not sterile. When I was trained as a neonatologist, not much more than a decade ago, and in my training we were told, and we went on to teach our trainees, that babies are sterile. And as we think about it today, as we start to understand more about microbes and how they interact with humans, it is a little hard to believe that anything in and on humans are sterile.
Right.
So it's something that is not actually unexpected now that we think more closely about it. But babies are essentially sterile. They do interact with quite a large bolus of bacteria at the time of delivery. And babies who are delivered by cesarean section, their first introduction to these large boluses of microbes are through the skin of their mom and the skin of the people in the operating room, and ultimately all the nurses and doctors and their family that handles them
And then vaginal delivery babies are also taking in through the mouth, I presumably, or just through their other ways as well?
Correct. So through the mouth and their nose, all of their mucous membranes and their skin, they're exposed to a large bolus of vaginal microbes that have evolved over time to be particularly health-promoting for babies with a very large bolus of lactobacillus in particular that is very helpful with babies so that they can digest their breast milk.
Hmm. So you also looked at the difference in the microbiome of babies who were fed differently, right? So with formula versus breastfed. What did you find?
Mm-hmm. So that was another factor that has been shown previously to be important for the development of the infant gut microbiome. What we did here that was a little different was that we looked at overall microbial community composition in three groups of babies. So we looked at exclusively breastfed babies and exclusively formula-fed babies, which have been studied a bit before. But we were also really interested in babies that are breastfed but supplemented with formula. And we know that that's something that commonly breastfeeding mothers do is supplement their babies with formula for various reasons. And so we were really interested in that group. And we knew that we expected there to be a difference between the exclusively breastfed babies and the exclusively formula-fed babies in terms of their gut microbiome composition. But what we weren't sure about was whether the combination-fed babies would be somewhere in between or if they would look more like the exclusively breastfed babies or the formula-fed babies in terms of their gut microbiome composition. And we were a bit surprised to find out that babies fed both breast milk and formula had a gut microbiome that resembled that of the babies that were fed exclusively formula, and that the exclusive breastfeeding was associated with a rather unique gut microbiome composition.
I mean, as someone, I have two kids. First one was only breast milk. Second one, I gotta admit, there was a little supplementing with formula. Should the nurses at the hospital have told me to resist the second time around?
It's a really great question, and one that I think plagues moms and pediatricians worldwide.
Yeah.
So when we think about that, it's important to think about it from a public health standpoint. And so the CDC and the AAP and ACOG, all of these very large health organizations are fully in support of exclusive breastfeeding. And so there has been quite a lot of research that's shown from an epidemiologic perspective about the vast and profound short and long-term health benefits of breast milk and exclusive breast milk. But what our study, I think, is getting at in a somewhat different perspective is we have not really understood in the past very well some of the mechanisms behind the health benefits of breast milk exposure. Mm. And ours has been able to show, as Annie explained, that there is a difference in microbial structure between babies who receive formula supplementation and those who do not. So Baby Friendly Hospital Initiative, led by the World Health Organization, the CDC, these are organizations that not only promote exclusive breastfeeding, but they're collecting data based on birth centers and how they're meeting goals of supporting moms in not providing formula unless it's medically necessary.
Yeah, I mean, that support element, it could definitely use some stepping up just from what I've seen in my own sort of experience. I want to ask you further with the breast milk. Do we know if it's the microbes or the actual nutrients in the milk that is helpful?
It's both. And so breast milk is very exciting to study. And again, it's somewhat of a black box, but we're starting to understand more and more about the health benefits of breast milk and the mechanism behind these health benefits. But breast milk is not just nutrition for babies. It's also a very important transfer of mom's immune system and her strength to her baby directly. So when babies are delivered, their immune system is very immature, and that's true for premature babies, but also for full-term healthy babies. And they're unable to fight off pathogens because their immune system is immature. So mom is transferring immune cells. She's transferring white cells, T cells, immunoglobulins. But there are also important bacteria that she's transferring that are health-promoting for her baby, as well as what we call prebiotics or special bioactive components in breast milk that feed healthy bacteria that are immune training for the baby's immune health.
I wanted to add that the breast milk has its own microbiome, and so in this cohort, as we collect stool samples from our infants enrolled in the cohort and analyze them in light of their microbiota, We're also collecting breast milk samples from the mothers. So we're profiling the breast milk microbiome as well, and we're also doing some nutrient profiling in these breast milk samples. So we should be able to get, in future research, we should be able to get at some of the relative effects of those different factors in breast milk that shape the gut microbiome of infants.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but did you previously do work on microbiome versus cystic fibrosis, or the sort of indicators there?
Yeah, so we my research program includes two high-risk baby populations, so babies who are born very prematurely. We've studied the intestinal microbiome in that population and how it relates to health. And we also have a large cohort of infants who were born with cystic fibrosis. We've enrolled nearly every baby in the state of New Hampshire born with cystic fibrosis since 2009. Hmm. And we're carefully following not only their health outcomes and their exposures, but we're also looking at their respiratory microbiome and their intestinal microbiome. And it's been a very rewarding research program, trying to understand the relationship between dietary exposures in babies and young children with cystic fibrosis and how the microbiome shapes their risk for disease.
And then in terms of thoughts of giving C-section babies a dose of the bacteria found in vaginal delivery babies, are people looking into that? Are they seeing if that could just sort of even the playing field, so to speak?
Yeah, there's a really exciting, some really exciting research going on right now at NYU that's looking at the effectiveness of potentially transferring the maternal vaginal microflora to newborn babies after they're born by C-section. So I think that research is ongoing, but it's really promising in terms of a very simple and low-cost intervention that might help to restore the microbiota in the gut of infants born by C-section to potentially a more health-promoting one, if that's the case. There are other, a lot of other exciting opportunities in terms of developing therapeutics through the administration of probiotics to kids and infants in early life that I think are just starting to be investigated. So we're really excited about that kind of research as well.
Manoush Zomorodi, this is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Anne and Juliet, I just want to double check with you. We want to make clear that we don't know if the difference between these two different microbiome, the bacteria, is good or a bad difference. We just know there is a difference, right?
That's correct. So we know that breast milk exclusivity epidemiologic studies is associated with terrific health benefits. So we know that babies who receive breast milk have lower risk of cancer and autoimmune disease, asthma. The list is quite long. And we're just starting to understand with research like ours some of the mechanisms behind why the biology of breast milk exposure is important. But our study today is simply defining what exposure shape the microbiome in infants' gut in a healthy population. And our study is hoping to see over the next 5 years with this cohort the relationship between these microbial patterns and some health outcomes.
And so in terms of long-term goals, I guess that is really the answer that you want to come to. Which are the ones that actually contribute to our health versus just sort of going along for the ride?
That's exactly right. We're hoping to understand in this healthy population what are the patterns in the gut microbiome in early life in this really critical window when microbes are required to interact with the immune system to develop a healthy immune system for a lifetime of health. If we can characterize the microbes in the gut in a healthy baby, we're hoping that we might be able to then dream up interventions so that we can tailor a healthy microbiome in high-risk populations or in populations who've had exposures that need to be remedied.
And just to clarify, what is the difference between, say, the mother or a healthy adult's microbiome versus an infant's? Do we know the difference?
I think we're starting to understand the difference. What we know about babies is that they are not necessarily sterile at birth, like we mentioned before, but that they are receiving quite large boluses of bacteria when they're introduced to the environment outside of the womb, and that there is quite a lot of variability and there's a lot of change in their gut microbiome over the first year to probably the first 3 years of life. And after about 3 years of life, it looks particularly stable and mirrors that of an adult's. So there's quite a lot of variability because things are becoming acquired over the course of infancy.
This is just fascinating. I am so looking forward to hearing what you discover as you go forward. Thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Juliet Madan is a pediatrician and neonatologist at the Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Anne Cohen is an assistant professor of epidemiology and of biomedical data science at the Geisel School of Medicine of Dartmouth College. So, one last thing before we go. Earlier this week, we heard of the death of pop star David Bowie. He had affected so many in so many ways, from his embracing of the different to Space Oddity, which was released just days before the moon landing. But David Bowie also always had an eye for changes and what was coming next, like in this 1999 interview with Jeremy Paxman of BBC Newsnight, in which he discusses the internet, then still young, and its effect on art and communications.
I don't think we've even seen the tip of the iceberg. I think the potential of what the internet is going to do to society, both good and bad, is unimaginable. I think we're actually on the cusp of something exhilarating and terrifying.
It's just a tool, though, isn't it?
No, it's not. No. No, it's an alien life form.
What do you think, I mean, when you think then about
it's their life on Mars. Yes, it's just landed here,
but that's yeah. It's a simply a different delivery system there. You're arguing about something more profound.
Oh yeah, I'm talking about the actual context and the state of content is going to be so different to anything that we can really envisage at the moment, where the interplay between the user and the provider will be so in simpatico. It's going to crush our ideas of what mediums are all about.
David Bowie was 69 years old. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Intaglia. Alexa Lim is our associate producer. Our SciArts producer is Annie Minoff. Luke Groskin is our video producer. We also had help today from Ella Fetter. Rich Kim is our technical director, and Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. You can email us at scifry@scifry.com. I'm Anoush Samarodi. Thanks so much for having me. Ira will be back next week.